Hey guys.
Hey everyone.
How's it going?
Yeah, I hope it's going well. Welcome to 2020. Actually,
we already did that.
We did that. But
welcome again.
Just you know, thank you for listening and tuning in to another episode of Eigen Bros.
Yes, indeed.
We're a little scared here.
Going into 2020. We're shaking up.
News of a nuclear apocalypse. It's making headlines, or potential World War III, and you know what that means.
Your boys had to give you some knowledge.
Yes. How to survive and what, you know, what to expect in case of a nuclear event.
Yeah, so basically this episode, we kind of divided up the nuclear scenario into three phases, was it?
Yeah,
one?
Yeah, about three.
And we try to give you guys some tips, some survival tips, and to also give you a little bit of understanding of what you're up against. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to give some practical knowledge and kind of prepare you for the worst. Mm-hmm. You know, just to have it in the back of your mind in case you survive, although it's pretty unlikely.
Yeah.
But, you know, you never know. So
you never know. If you're one of the lucky ones, you know, erect statues of the physics heroes.
Right.
Hopefully you walked away with some general sense of knowledge where you could rebuild society in a scientific way. So that, you know, instead of religion, you know, you could build it fundamentally from rationality.
Right. You can start everything off right.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully, you know, nothing against religious people, but, you know, we you know, if this is a perfect chance to try something new.
Well said, Juan.
Yeah. So look at the silver lining. Okay. So basically, yeah. Just hopefully you walked away with some little inkling of hope that you could maybe make it out alive. Like, comment, and subscribe.
Share this
with your family.
Because
they need to know. They can fast forward, like, you know, to wherever parts you need to, but as long as they know the information that they need to survive, you know, unless you want to impress them.
You know, but the more minds on it, the better.
Yes. The more everyone is on the same page, the better. So
exactly. So yeah, guys, make sure you also check out the website, eigenbros.com. Check out our Twitter at eigenbros. Pretty active on Twitter. Check out our Instagram. That's eigenbros. And we also have a TikTok, eigenbros2. Mm-hmm. And we will see you guys in a bit. Mm-hmm. Ready, Freddy?
3, 2, 1. We're live.
We are live.
Put a nuclear blast. Ooh. I need you to put a nuclear blast at this point.
Put a big mushroom cloud.
Yeah, exactly. You guessed it, folks. Today we're talking about nuclear fallout.
Uh-oh.
Nuclear holocaust, whatever you want to call it.
Indeed.
An apocalyptic event that would decimate, according to some estimates, 80% of the U.S. population.
Was that what it says?
Yeah.
Shit.
Well. So, depending on where you are.
It's going to be a lighthearted episode, I guess, huh?
And the reason why we're talking about this is because, well, a lot of talks of nuclear war have been happening.
World War III.
Yep. World War III, everybody.
Yep.
Welcome to the 2020s. It's been 100 years since the First World War. And about. And you know, it's about time, you know, history repeats itself, and so here we are.
what are your first thoughts about that one, the whole Iran situation?
Well, you texted me out of the blue the other day, and you were like, hey, so World War III, literally January 1st, you were like,
yeah,
what did you say? I can't remember.
I forget. Let me read it.
Something along the lines of like,
probably like this orange dickhead.
No, you said what a way to start the new decade or something, which is, which is just anyway, not the one thing you want to. Not even Happy New Year's. You didn't even say Happy New Year's. You were just like,
that's true. I just said, great. We get to start 2020 with World War III.
Yeah.
And I sent it to you on January 2nd.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. I thought it was the first. Well, yeah. I mean, welcome to the season finale of the U.S. of America.
It's been a wild ride.
It's been fun, everybody. It's anyway, I was kind of shocked to hear, because it was the holidays, so I was out of town and visiting the family and was out of the loop, out of everything, and then just seeing, trying to stay off social media, you know, unplugging and stuff. And so, yeah, it was kind of shocking to hear, but not necessarily surprised. If we want to, if I want to get into politics a little bit, let me just divert it here. I'm just talking political science. I'm not, this is not something that's, I'm not picking sides here, by the way. So a president is more likely to get reelected during wartime. I'm sorry, this is just the way it is. So it's a political move, I imagine, by this administration, the Trump administration, to give him better polling results, to try to get real. And in fact, I had friends on Facebook that said he made the right decision and stuff like that, and I'm like, oh, you know, whatever. If you want to
to be fair, the guy that was assassinated, his name is Soleimani. I think Soleimani or something. I can't remember exactly how to pronounce his name, but he is definitely a, like, a terroristic guy, and has killed many, you know, U.S.
A despot, I would say.
Yes, killed many U.S. Soldiers and whatnot. But the problem is he is so powerful. So he is the second most powerful guy in Iran, and that they've been comparing it to killing the vice president of the U.S.
Which is, do you think that's appropriate? A magnitude of responsibility for that?
Well, I'm not an expert at all by any means on politics, so I will never claim that I have a reasonably informed opinion about that, but I am just going to concede to the experts that use that power comparison and say that I guess that must be true.
Yeah.
And from what I've seen, it seems accurate to me. Although I know a lot of the Iranian people don't really agree with their government, you know, because the Iran regime is kind of oppressive. And I know that a lot of the people there aren't, they don't buy into that whole methodology, but either way, you know, he has that level of power.
Right.
So it's not a wise thing to kill someone out of the blue who has that kind of level of influence.
Yeah. It's funny. I actually, we have mutual friends that are Iranian.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there's a ton of physicists that are Iranian. In our department.
And and I'm sure in your departments too, depending on where you're at, there might be a number of them.
I feel really bad for them, man, because they've had to make so many decisions based on politics just over the last, you know, four or 5 years here.
Yeah.
You know, because there was the whole situation with the Muslim ban, whatever you want to politically correctly call it, I forget. Yeah. But it was just basically banning all these Muslim countries, and a lot of them didn't even want to go home. We had friends that were going to have weddings back at their back in Iran, but they couldn't because politics. They didn't want to be they didn't want to be barred from coming back into the U.S.
Yeah,
and then now it's like this situation happens, and it's just like, man.
Yeah, I know somebody who's married, and they can't go see their spouse.
Wow,
you know. They can't see their significant other because if they go, they're never coming back. And it's just politics, man. It's not a pretty thing.
No.
And speaking of ugly things, you know, if in the event that a nuclear attack happens, which I think right now we're at a DEFCON, DEFCON 2?
What's the levels? There's DEFCON 5,
DEFCON
I know.
DEFCON 5 is, I think, is the highest. I think it's kind of, you would think I think DEFCON 1 is the highest.
You sure?
It's kind of counterintuitive.
Because I know there's like a spray or something that's like called DEFCON 5, and I assume that would be like the highest, the highest level, right?
Because
you always
want
to advertise the highest.
Yeah, maybe you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. I can't be for sure.
I'm not sure what DEFCON level we're at, or if you want to go back to 2001, I'm not sure what code color we are.
Oh, there you go.
So
probably like orange, I think.
Yeah, we're probably at an orange right now. It's kind of if you're an alarmist, you're probably a little scared, or if you're, you know, if you're worried about you know, what are your chances of surviving a nuclear event striking near you. If you're on the East Coast, you're kind of SOL. So
the odds are not great.
Not for us at all, because strategically speaking, the if you want to take out, this is a game of chess, people, you know, war is a game of numbers, really.
Sure.
You're trying to ruin the economy of the other person. And what better way to ruin the economy by striking, you know, one of the biggest, you go for the biggest cities, really.
Yeah.
New York, L.A.
Uh-huh. Atlanta,
you know. Houston, you know, yep. Yeah, and there's a lot of Air Force bases outside of those big cities for a good reason. And I mean, those are the biggest major targets. If you live in any major U.S. city, you're already in trouble.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
It's not looking good.
No.
And of course, you want to hit all of them if you can, mm-hmm. ideally.
Yes. Unfortunately, if you live, and a lot of the major cities are coastal cities too, mm-hmm. which are easily prone to nuclear submarine attacks.
Sure, exactly.
So it's like, you know, you're just, I hate yeah. to say it, but yeah, okay. But this is why the U.S. actually has a lot of major, if you look at maps that are out there posted, maybe I'll send you the link so you can have this particular map, but it shows particular strike zones or
I've seen it
blackout parts where yeah the middle of the U.S. is completely like you should not be there because it's a concentrated, that's where the most of the big Air Force bases are, or like the biggest bases are located.
I didn't know that,
but it makes sense, right? Because that's where you want to have all your assets, because right. the enemy has to work much harder to get to those.
Yeah.
So if you're there, the center of the U.S., the Midwest is kind of off limits, really. That would be the first, strategically, that would be the first for sure to be striked.
Right, because you want to get rid of all their weapons for their chances to retaliate.
Yeah. So if you're in the Midwest, I'm sorry to say, but you might be in trouble.
Sounds like nowhere's safe, really.
I mean, there are a few places. In fact, I looked it up.
What are the few places that are safe?
So in the U.S., I think Oregon was one of them.
The hipsters are saved.
Yeah, the hipsters are safe. Northern Nevada. Oh, no, okay. Northern, is it Nevada or New Mexico? No, definitely not New Mexico.
Yeah, I was going to say, no way.
Yeah. Definitely Nevada.
New Mexico's got national labs, too.
Yeah, no way. No. And then Alaska. And then a good chunk of like Michigan and Illinois, all those states up there by Canada. I think they would be okay.
Chicago's safe?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. I don't know what they have.
I don't know. Like it,
Chicago doesn't have any like weapons programs or anything.
I don't think so. I don't know.
Okay.
But those states that are up there by the Great Lakes, if you're from another country, just look, Google it or whatever.
Yeah, Great Lakes are like Michigan, Erie,
what's the acronym, the other home ones are. Or something?
I don't know.
Huron,
dude.
Ontario, Huron. Michigan, and Erie. Yeah,
okay, nice. I never heard that.
Fuck it. Yeah, home, man. But yeah, it's you definitely. So those I think are the couple places that you'd be okay. Everywhere else, if there's a naval base near you, it's probably
lights out.
I mean, I'm sorry to say. I mean, you won't be nuclear. You won't be stricken by you. You're not likely to be hit by a nuclear nuclear. How would you say this? Missile, but you probably, if the U.S. became a all-out battle zone, that would be. You would definitely feel some artillery or something. You know what I'm saying? Like
artillery would have to be if they take it to land, take it to the U.S., which would be unlikely.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, it would definitely be nuclear, probably submarine strikes or some kind of like.
They'd have to like circumvent our systems in a way that's, you know, like nukes or something or missiles, because it's going to be a lot harder to get to the U.S. Land of USA.
And by that point, folks, we're already done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Everybody's annihilated at that point, because, you know, the U.S. is going to strike immediately too, and then we're just going to start going ham with missiles.
Yeah, and really, the only saving grace for us is that, well, we have, a lot of people have guns, but if the enemy has, you know, drones or whatever, if your enemy isn't human, then
it's just
kind of futile.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I actually just was hearing Putin speak about how they have, they're the only ones that have hypersonic missiles so far and hypersonic weapons. I was surprised by that. Mm-hmm. I didn't do research to check if that was true, but it's just interesting. I was like, oh, Russia has hypersonic weapons now. I'm surprised. And he was bragging about how they were ahead of everyone in terms of technology.
I mean, we keep things tight-lipped a lot of the time. So I wouldn't be surprised if we also have something like that.
But then again, you know, Trump's probably just
emailing Putin all the
all
the information.
Yeah, exactly. It's and also for you folks in the southern hemisphere, you're actually in your chances of survivability are way higher than anybody living in North America or north of the equator. And that's
isn't all of the U.S. north of the equator?
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. Oh, your chances of surviving if you live below, like, south of the
equator.
So if
you're, like, South America or something.
South America, Australia, New Zealand, like,
why
all
is that?
Those other, South Africa. Because all of the, a lot of the north equator countries have nuclear weapons. Almost all of them have. All of them. Almost all of them have. Above the, so that whole north, the whole
area
north side of the equator
somehow
is going to be, if
destroyed.
We're talking about mutually assured destruction, mm-hmm, where both sides send nuclear weapons to each other, the north of the equator is fucked.
I see.
Pardon my French, but yeah, we're fucked.
Do you know what South American countries have nukes?
I think very few, and even then, those would be the northern ones again. Northern part
Okay.
of those countries.
I see. The northern part of South America is what you're
yeah,
saying.
Yeah, yeah, like okay. Argentina maybe. But all those countries have a lot of, they have their own probably turmoil, internal conflict that they probably never really cared about.
I see.
Having nuclear weapons to begin with.
Right, right.
But yeah.
Does India have nukes, do you know?
Probably, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I know India just, they just finally landed on the moon because they developed their ISRO space program.
Yeah.
So I would imagine they have some kind of nuclear capability.
Yeah. I
not
mean,
sure, though.
Unfortunately.
Because those two don't necessarily correlate, but it means you might be able to send long-range missiles.
Right. Right.
But who knows?
Who knows? It's very fascinating. I used to be very much into survivalism. Like surviving mm-hmm. apocalyptic events.
Yeah.
Because as a physicist, you're kind of I feel like you have all the tools to reason through how to survive
mm-hmm.
life-threatening scenarios.
Indeed.
So, I don't know. I feel like you had something here to say.
Yeah. So I thought that we could kind of go through mm-hmm. I guess some ways on how we can survive a nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. But I guess first I kind of wanted to touch upon like what we're up against.
Mm-hmm.
So as you know, nuclear weapons are this super advanced technology that was developed during World War II. That was the first time and the only time nukes have ever been used in actual combat. So, of course, everybody knows of the infamous Hiroshima and Nagasaki incident.
Yeah.
You know, where I believe it was Truman. Is that correct? Corroborate me one. I don't want to sound dumb.
I don't think so.
Okay, well.
Let's hold off on that.
Some unknown guy.
I think it's Roosevelt or one of the Roosevelts, right?
I don't think so.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
But
sorry.
One of these guys, one of these presidents.
Sorry, high school teacher.
Yeah.
Taught me history.
One of these presidents that I forget who it was.
Mm-hmm.
Dropped the bomb on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, mm-hmm. and that was kind of the end of the war, I believe, right?
Yeah, that was the thing that really told everybody that we're not playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was the final statement of we run this shit now.
Yeah, and it wasn't even like the biggest bomb in our arsenal.
No, so that was those were fission bombs.
Yeah.
So I actually wanted to talk about that. Nowadays we have fusion bombs. So fusion is supposed to be, the damage on that is 100 to 1,000 times greater than any of the bombs you could ever have seen with Hiroshima or Nagasaki.
Yeah.
So we already know the mass devastation with the fission bombs.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it doesn't even compare to a fusion bomb.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to just talk about kind of fission and fusion real quick. Since this is a physics podcast, mm-hmm. we can kind of talk about it a little bit. So,
sure.
You know, I always wondered how the fuck can you make something that devastatingly powerful, you know?
I mean, it's astounding. I just, the level of, like, you have to. So the first nuclear bomb, like you were saying, was invented post-World War I. I think the motivation was because we didn't want to have to fight another war like that, to that level of casualty.
Yeah.
on our side.
And that was kind of the like final answer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so a group of physicists were tasked to basically go to Los Alamos, and we got a lot of ex German scientists. I think some of them Nazis, some of them not. I don't know. I think it's like there's an operation. I don't know if it was called Paperclip or something. I don't know.
I don't know anything about it.
But there was
the Manhattan Project. What you're
but the Manhattan Project was the name of the official project that was given to these scientists and physicists that were tasked to make a nuclear bomb. And yes. So, because there were reports that in Europe that the rise of the Third Reich, I guess, that the Nazis, I guess, were I guess, accumulating weapons.
Too much power.
Mm. Maybe I'm getting this a little bit wrong because I'm remembering from like over 10 years ago at this point.
People must be so annoyed by us not looking up things.
Off the cuff, man.
If you want to work for free and be our Googler.
Yeah, you want to be a producer or ombudsman.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's... but I think this is generally the correct interpretation of the events that how it went down. So... so anyway, Einstein was a part of this group. Oppenheimer, I think von Neumann too?
Yep, von Neumann.
It had a massive roster.
Insane
cast of like the world's leading physicists.
Yeah.
You know, a young Richard Feynman was there.
Was Dyson there too?
I don't know. Okay, I think he was more engineering, maybe.
Because Dyson, yeah, he was an interesting guy. I don't remember if he was on the Manhattan Project though.
Maybe so, who knows. But
okay, anyway.
But yeah, I mean, those guys were all there, and like I mentioned Einstein, right?
I don't know if you did.
Einstein was there.
Of course, the Mac Daddy. Mr. E equals MC squared himself.
Yeah, the magnanimous E equals MC squared. Yeah, he was there. He was working on the project, and a lot of those guys were there for it, and what... Yeah, I mean, just the level of physics that you had to know, I guess, at that point to create that you need quantum mechanics, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Although not like crazy level. I think it's just like atomic physics.
Yeah,
you just kind of have to know that.
Because they didn't have the quantum mechanics when
they,
Manhattan Project
they kind of
was
did.
Done. Okay.
They kind of had an idea, but it was still very like...
it was wishy-washy.
They were still piecing it together.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the level of, you just had to know atomic physics, which is kind of what we were coming to terms with, I guess.
I see.
Better than fundamental quantum mechanics. So,
right.
So, yeah, quantum mechanics, nuclear physics,
mm-hmm.
That's pretty much when it started developing greatly.
Okay.
And so, yeah, it just, but I honestly don't know the difference between fusion and fission, because I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I've...
Yes, yeah, so let's make it real simple. Yeah. So it pretty much is what it sounds like. So with fission reactions, let me kind of describe what a fission bomb does. Mm-hmm. So the fission, well, let me think. So there's two types of bombs, as we said, the fission bomb and the fusion bomb. Fission is a process in which you have the uranium-235 atom.
Mm-hmm.
The uranium-235 atom splits into two different atoms. So you can imagine there's a collection of protons and electrons and neutrons, and they split when there's a neutron that gets hit, or when a neutron bombards that uranium atom.
Mm-hmm.
That's fission.
Yeah.
Fusion would be like the opposite, where the two atoms combine.
Mm.
So you have two different energy releases there, and the fusion bomb has a greater energy release than the fission one. But basically, you're like, okay, how does that make a bomb? Well,
what is the driver? What is the catalyst?
Right. So the catalyst is basically that neutron. So uranium-235 is very unstable in the sense. Well, it's stable yet unstable. It's stable. Well, we use it because it is stable, but it becomes unstable when you bombard it with a neutron. So it's like it puts it just over that cliff of instability once a neutron hits. So if you guys are familiar with the four fundamental forces of nature, there's, you know, the gravity force, we have the strong, weak, and then of course the electromagnetic forces. And an atom,
you forgot one.
What was the one I forgot?
Love. I'm kidding. All right.
But anyway. But the thing is, you have your, so you have your, let's imagine we have your uranium atom, right? Mm-hmm. All these protons are jumbled up in the nucleus. Yeah. But if you know from elementary physics, like charges don't want to attract, they want to repel, right?
Yes.
So you're like, how the fuck can a bunch of protons be clumped together and stay together? Mm-hmm. You have another force that overrides the electromagnetic force, which is what usually repels the protons, mm-hmm. called the strong force.
Yes.
So the strong force is a very strong force, but it's very short range. Mm-hmm. So it holds all these protons together, mm-hmm. but with the uranium atom, there's a gigantic ball of protons, so much so that the strong force can't hold them all together. Mm. It's holding them on by a thread. Mm-hmm. And when you start to get really far away from the nucleus, the electromagnetic force starts to pull at these protons, gotcha. And they want to start pulling apart. So when a neutron is sent to this atom, mm-hmm. it puts them over the top just enough to where the electromagnetic force can do its work, mm-hmm. and actually pull apart the atom and separate it into two different atoms.
So this causes a sort of cascading effect.
Exactly. And so it's a cascade effect, because once those atoms are separated, it's a chain reaction to where if you have a bunch of these uranium-235 atoms, it's a domino effect where all of these reactions go off, and now you have a giant energy release, because you have an accumulation of energy release, and that energy release manifests into this giant explosion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's essentially what a fission bomb is.
Yeah. So the reaction itself is sort of analogous to like almost any basic chemical reaction in a way, right?
Yeah.
But it just happens to be because we use this particular element.
Yeah.
Right?
It's just very high energy.
Yeah.
Very high energy.
It releases a lot of energy. Yeah. 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 So there you have it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a fission bomb. And then basically the fusion bomb is kind of like a pseudo fusion bomb. We don't really actually have a real fusion bomb, because we actually use fission to actually catalyze the reaction for fusion bombs, mm-hmm, as well. Mm-hmm. So you have some fission reaction. That fission reaction causes a fusion reaction, mm-hmm. that's secondary once you have the primary fusion reaction, gotcha. Or fission reaction going off. So essentially the same thing, only that fission causes deuterium and tritium to fuse together, and that releases energy when they combine.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I won't get too much into the details, but that's essentially the two bombs.
Astounding.
Riveting, folks.
I wasn't aware of, once you told me, I remembered back reading in my undergrad books.
Yeah.
Because any modern physics textbook, you can pretty much pick it up and get an idea of what goes into making a nuclear bomb.
Yeah.
Like that. So, it's,
It's clever shit. It's like, it's clever. It feels like something I would never come up with. I just don't see how they came up with that shit.
I could see why they needed a group, a big group of like the leading physicist guys to like hammer this out.
Yeah. It's really clever stuff. Yeah. It's interesting. It's like, damn.
Yeah. And I mean, do you know the numbers of like how, I guess maybe I kind of led with it a little bit.
Yeah.
If this attacked any major city, are you pretty much done? Like if you're live in the vicinity of say you're in the middle of, we're talking about, I guess maybe blast radius or something. Yeah. Do you know a number off the top of your head? Like what,
how many people would survive?
No. Just like what the blast radius looks like for a fusion or nuclear. I mean,
I don't really, of course. The thing is, most of the bombs that we hold are fusion, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure a lot of other people use probably just fusion because the reactions are so much greater.
Yeah.
Right. So of course with a fusion bomb, your odds are looking really bad. So if you're at the epicenter of the blast, there's virtually zero possibility of survival. Mm-hmm. You're going to be vaporized instantly. And that goes on for several miles. I think outside of about 5 miles is when you have a bit of survivability. So
no, I think that seems too low. 5 miles?
Outside of 5 miles is you have a bit of survivability typically. But how? I think it depends on
the... You
have
to be underground or something?
Yeah. So there's ways. So You're saying that sounds too little of a range for the blast radius?
Yeah.
Well, when I say little survivability, I mean very, very little.
Okay.
Like, you're probably still going to die, but yeah. Your odds go up slightly better.
Yeah, okay.
But, yeah, that initial blast radius is pretty much done. 5 miles, I think you get a little bit barely more survivability.
Don't count on it, folks.
Yeah, probably not.
Because I'm guessing you need to be at least, if you're maybe 200, no. If you're maybe 100 miles away,
you should be.
Your survivability is much better than.
Yeah,
say 50.
I think 100 miles is pretty good survivability.
Yeah. Like, because if you're an hour, imagine this: if you're an hour away from outside of a major city where the blast happened, you're still gonna feel the blast.
Yeah, yeah.
In fact, that blast is probably. Yeah, you would probably fly away. Like,
yeah,
you probably die.
Your skin will probably burn off, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to get cooked pretty much. Your skin will burn off. And then after that, of course, that's just the heat wave. The blast wave is going to hit. And I mean, those can get up to 600 miles per hour. And then you're pretty much, there's no way you're going to survive that pretty much.
Yeah.
And that's just the initial phase. So basically, the key to surviving a nuclear blast. Yeah, the key to surviving a nuclear blast is if you can survive first. Don't get vaporized at the epicenter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much up to chance.
Yeah.
You got to try to survive the heat wave.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, if you can cover yourself up, what you want to do is you want to get under some shelter. So you got to get away from windows. You got to get away from any kind of surface. A good thing I looked up before was just to go into sewers. So sewers and underground places are good to hide out in.
Mm-hmm.
You want to get away from the heat wave, and then you also want to try to avoid the blast rate, the shock wave.
Yeah.
So the shock wave is going to blow away all kinds of buildings and things, and you don't want to be in a building.
No.
Unless it's very, very robust.
Yeah.
And that's like, you'd have to be out far enough. It'd have to be such a robust building that it's built for nuclear blasts.
Yeah. If you're on the seventh floor of a building, consider yourself just.
Yeah. Like a skyscraper, it's over. It's pretty much not happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, because like I said, the winds are going to be up 600 miles an hour, and there's no hurricanes that hit like that. So
No. You
haven't seen that kind of wind force.
Sorry, folks. Yeah.
But yeah, so what you want to do is you want to get underground. So
yes.
The key to survivability, I think, with nuclear stuff is you want to try to get in either the best one is a nuclear
shelter
that's built specifically for that. Or B, you got to get underground somehow. So you got to get away from the sun. You got to get away from outside and shield yourself as much as possible with as many layers as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So that's phase one. So once you've gone through phase one, that's pretty much the hard part. So if you get past phase one, well, that's like the part where if you don't get past phase one, I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you go past phase one, the next 48 hours determine whether you're going to live or not.
Yeah.
Really.
So that 48-hour mark, actually, Juan, that's a good point that you made. Mm-hmm. That 48-hour mark is really the major part of survivability. So this is in phase two.
Yeah.
Phase two, you cannot by any means go above ground.
Do not.
For 48 hours. And that's because of all the high, high energy radiation, the gamma radiation that gets left behind. So that's the most deadly
100%
form of radiation that you're going to face after the nuclear blast. So that 48 hours is going to linger. And if you go up then, it's pretty much you're guaranteed going to die. You'll be exposed to too much radiation and you can't survive that.
Yeah.
So
if the person becomes, if there's a person that you know or something, it becomes like a zombie scenario because if somebody is exposed to too much radiation and they're trying to join your bunker, you got to just be like, I'm sorry, but...
Well, they can join.
No, because...
Because the radiation is not contagious. It's not like it's going to...
It's not contagious, but I'm saying if they're exposed to enough radiation where it's like they... Well, I mean, maybe not. But maybe if they bring some
they
stuff that's radioactive or something.
Okay, yeah.
That's
so
what I'm saying.
So you got to be careful, of course. So the thing is, you're going to have to be on radiation duty now until the end of however long it's going to be.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Probably the entire time.
Probably.
For at least months.
5 years.
I don't know
about
the time
scale. I think after a year,
there might be some chance
to
go out.
You might be able to go out and
okay.
Like,
I didn't look up how long you have to be away from it.
I looked this up like over 10 years ago,
okay.
Man. I was all into this shit. I was like, I don't know.
Maybe during that Hawaii scare.
No, it was
you said
10
years ago.
That.
Okay, yeah.
Way before that. I don't know what I was freaking out about.
Something. Maybe Kim Jong-un or something.
I don't know. I was kind of obsessed with it. In fact, I have a little something.
What?
Oh, I should have grabbed it when I was in the restroom. But I bought some iodine tablets. And in fact, if you hear nuclear sirens, buy iodine tablets, by the way. Iodine tablets, they help a little bit if you want to just get away from... They help reduce the amount, apparently, they help reduce the amount of radiation that you absorb.
Mm. I read that about iodine.
Yeah. So.
But you just put it under your body?
You swallow it. It's a pill. You just swallow it. You take it. And it helps your body kind of survive for like a short amount of time. I don't know the chemistry of it. I never looked into it. But all I remember is maybe consider buying a good little supply of iodine tablets.
Smart.
Tablets, not
the salts.
I can
corroborate that a little bit because I did read something about iodine being helpful for radiation exposure.
And just like I'm not talking about like Terrence is saying, the first, if you're caught in the blast, you're probably not going to survive.
Yeah, but iodine won't save you.
No, but if you're 100 miles away and because you're going to see the explosion before anything. You're going to see the light before you see anything.
And that's another thing is don't look at the explosion because you'll be blinded. And then if you're blind, like,
you're pretty much
don't
dead.
Make your survivability harder.
Yeah, don't stare at it. Look away and just run or go the opposite direction.
Yeah.
Or find shelter immediately. And if you have an iodine tablet, take it because that'll increase your chances of not getting radiation poisoning. Because obviously light is a form of radiation, but that you don't know what those particles... Well, like what sort of sequence the particles or the gamma rays or whatever are going to come in.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So yeah, it's...
You'll be cooking your eyes.
So just... Yeah. I mean, these are high energy particles we're talking about.
Yeah.
You know,
and remember, light speed is 300,000, kilometers per second. So it's going to be in an instant. You can't blink it away.
No, you can't.
So don't even try. So, you know, once you see it, it's over.
Right. If you see a bright light, take the tab, run to your fucking, wherever you keep it, take a tablet, go find shelter immediately and just hope for the best.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first 48, like Terrence is saying, they're very crucial to your survivability. If you don't. Yeah. And if you have like a scenario where you have like a bag, so there's a thing that survivalists call a bug out bag. I don't know if you read
it. Oh, I never heard about it.
So you need to have a bag of like the most basic survivability things that you need, that you would need. So maybe more iodine tablets, something like a portable water filter, maybe some, a two-way like radio,
some kind of communication. What's it called?
Like walkie-talkies or even like a ham radio or something. Mm. A ham radio would serve you best probably. And then, or just like a radio that you can maybe get signal from the federal government to try to figure out where shelter is.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to survive. You're not going to, like, unless you're already in a bunker, you're not going to survive like living out on your own in this scenario very long.
Yeah, I think definitely grouping up is good.
Yeah.
You know, some people might think, oh, it's not because then I won't have enough food or rations and whatnot. But no, your survivability will increase if you have a partner.
Yeah.
You know, so you want to definitely be in a group. Mm-hmm. So the radiation part is the phase two you want to try to avoid. So, you know, 48 hours, you got to make sure you have plenty of food. You know, the food part, you need to have things that are preserved, you know, canned goods, that kind of stuff that lasts a long time are usually the best option.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you got to ration off your food. So, you know, don't watch Netflix and binge a bunch, binge all of your survival food.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're going to try to, in your bug out bag, you're going to, the basic things are like you're saying food, but very calorie dense foods. If you want, there are probably military grade bug out bags or military grade bags where they have rationing like sort of stuff where you just add a little bit of water and you can consume it. Water is obviously going to be the most important thing that you need to have. Clean water, at least. Clean water would be the number one, literally the number one thing that's going to be rare as shit, because you cannot collect rainwater in a scenario where radiation and you can't and everything else is suspect, because if everything is radioactive, you know, with the fallout and everything, you're going to have radiation everywhere. And
right. And of course, one, you're like referring to the nuclear winter.
So this is phase three, technically.
Yeah,
right?
Let's. Yeah. So we can move on to phase three. So yeah. Once that 48 hours is cleared and whatnot, the high energy, the really high energy particles are still going to be there, but the ones that are going to kill you within a few days are going to be suppressed.
Yeah, yeah.
So, of course, you want to limit your exposure to going outside because, yeah. you know, you still will get lethal doses of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, give yourself radiation poisoning. And once you have radiation poisoning, I mean, there's no turning back. You will die.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that nuclear winter is essentially, it's like they call it winter because it's basically all the debris and particulate that has blown off during the shockwave.
Yeah.
Dust, raining
soil,
yep.
Yeah, yeah,
all of that material raining back down onto the blast zone. So all that stuff is going to be highly radioactive and you're going to be getting it all over you. So the next step is you have to try to mitigate as much radiation exposure as you can. So you need to be wearing suits, you need to be wearing things that
filter the air.
Yeah, you need to filter the air. So if you have masks on, you need to have that because you don't want to breathe it in. Because even if you breathe in, that's even worse because alpha particles are the lowest form of ionizing radiation.
Mm-hmm.
They can be blocked by clothes and, you know, thin sheets of paper. But if you breathe them in, then that's going to damage you.
Going directly into your body.
So, yeah. So you want to try to reduce all forms of radiation as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Beta particles are going to be hard to block because those are the next level up in terms mm-hmm. of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Those can be blocked by like, you know, a little less than 1.5 feet of mm-hmm. lead, or, you know, about six and a half feet of concrete. So that's going to only be able to be blocked probably in a shelter, maybe mm-hmm. some kind of special radiation suit. And then, of course, gamma rays are the highest energy ones. Those are going to exist regardless, and you can't really block those. So
No. You'll
have to account for most of your radiation poisoning coming from gamma rays.
Yes.
So, of course, in a radiation scenario, you also need to be able to detect that. So you won't have Geiger counters.
Mm-hmm.
So you're already familiar.
Put that in your bug out bag if you can.
Yeah. So yeah. A Geiger counter is essentially just a way to detect where radiation is. So it's the thing that kind of has that staticky sound as you're walking around, and you'll actually detect when there's radiation when you start to hear that really distinct static.
It's literally just a count.
Yeah, so every time it counts a radiation particle, it makes a static sound.
Yeah.
So the more static you hear, that's the more radiation going into the Geiger counter.
So it's a counter that has like detects a certain energy, particle energy threshold, and anything above that is going to be like, oh, this is a high energy particle,
right?
And it's like, oh, it counts the particle.
So
the higher beeping, the you know, then you're in trouble, get away,
right? So I was thinking of a way, so just to kind of divert along that line a little bit, so I was kind of thinking like, okay, Geiger counter would be nice, but like, who the fuck as a civilian has Geiger counters? So I wanted to kind of like think of some ways of how can you detect the radiation.
One?
Yeah, so I was thinking you could actually make a cloud chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if you've seen cloud chambers before, one.
No.
So these cloud chambers are kind of these fun little experiments people do. They are made to show trails of... I actually included a picture of it, didn't
mm-hmm.
I? Glad
mm-hmm.
you remembered. So they actually show trails of cosmic rays, usually.
Mm-hmm.
So, or we'll just say radioactive particles. You know, a lot of times they'll do it for, you know, like physics outreach experiments and whatnot. But basically, you can build a cloud chamber yourself if you just have some kind of chamber. Of course, you need some ingredients that might be hard to come by. Like you need dry ice. You would need a chamber, of course, some kind of clear chamber. You need a flashlight. You would need isopropyl alcohol. And you would need some kind of sponge or something. So, of course, isopropyl is going to be hard to come by as a normal civilian as well. So I think maybe you could do the same thing with ethanol, which I think is a little bit easier, but I don't know for sure.
Yeah.
So you'd have to verify that.
You can probably skim by with your supermarket grade, probably. Not too high accuracy.
Well,
but
the thing is, rubbing alcohol I think they do sell isopropyl alcohol in the stores.
They do.
But it's only 71%.
No, I've seen, I have 91.
Do you really? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, so 91 should be enough.
Yeah.
If you can purchase 91%, okay, I'm glad you actually know that one, because I wasn't sure if you can purchase 91%.
Yeah, you can.
So if you can purchase 91%, then that would work.
Yeah.
So if you can make a cloud chamber, which is just those ingredients, you can actually see high energy particles going through that cloud chamber. The problem is you do have to be in a dark, in the dark, or else you won't really see it clearly. So you'd have to build a chamber that's dark. Yeah. So
because there's no electricity.
So if it is dark, then you should be able to see the particles, and you'll see a bunch of cosmic, or not cosmic rays, you'll see a bunch of high energy particles coming in from that nuclear radiation.
Yeah.
So that can be kind of a shitty Geiger counter if you have nothing.
Yeah, if you have literally nothing. So the way you would construct this would be like you have maybe a Tupperware or something for the audio listeners, because for the visual aspect of it, we'll have a picture. But if you're just listening audio, you know, imagine taking a Tupperware and putting basically isopropyl alcohol or whatever, just, you know, supermarket.
On a sponge.
Rubbing alcohol. And then you put it on you put the alcohol inside of the container, the Tupperware, and then you put a sponge at, how would you say it?
Well, this is kind of a different version.
Yeah.
Like, literally all you need to do is you just need a container. So imagine you have like a Petri dish or something.
No, that's something common, like Tupperware,
okay, sure. Some if you plastic. Have a Tupperware, all you have to do is just put the sponge on the bottom of the Tupperware and then just pour the alcohol on and then have a seal. That's all you need.
Yeah.
And then once you have that, you can put the dry ice on top, or put it on top of dry ice or something. Well, I think
maybe
you might need dry ice. I can't remember why.
Because it's cold enough to condense the alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. So I think you need dry ice, not regular ice. Although I haven't tried it.
Either way, if you don't have access, try to get something as cold as you can.
Yeah, and it might work. And you can get dry ice at stores. So if you raid the supermarket, you may be able to find some dry ice or something.
I mean, if it's the first 48 hours, then you might be able to find some dry ice.
Yeah, I can't remember. But you also may be able to make dry ice. I don't know if you can or not. I'd have to look it up.
Very hard.
You think?
Yeah. I think you're better off just rummaging
through
a store
point,
finding a hardware store, going look, find a Geiger counter of sorts.
Yeah.
Unless you know an electrical engineer.
Yeah, so that'd be the ultimate. So if you knew somebody who could make a Geiger counter, you might also be able to make one. I looked up a way to make a Geiger counter, but I wasn't really satisfied with the DIY method. Mm-hmm. Although the methodology behind Geiger counters is actually pretty simple.
Yes, yes.
So all it is you just need a tube that has an inert gas, like let's say like xenon or something. I don't remember what the inert gas is specific or not, but let's just say it's some inert gas, right? Something that has all of the energy levels filled.
We're talking about noble gases for you chemistry. For the people that aren't familiar, I guess.
Yeah. So I think the key is just something that has a full energy shell. Yeah.
Argon, like you're saying, xenon.
Xenon, I think. Neon. Neon?
So maybe you might luck out on this, but if you can't find a tube like that, I think you could maybe use a cathode ray tube, right? From CRT, like
inert gas inside.
I think those have inert gas.
I think all light bulbs do too.
Yeah,
light bulbs have argon gas or something.
So you
in
may
them.
Be you may be able to fashion something if you find an old TV, old light bulbs. We're talking really old light bulbs.
Yeah, the incandescents do. The fluorescents don't have it.
No.
Okay. Okay.
But you have to find really old light bulbs, like you're saying, like back in the day where the filament, they wanted to seal it and basically vacuum.
Right. Right.
But those are hard to come by probably.
But you also may even be able to find something like neon tube. The neon lights have neon in them. So you might be able to get it that way too.
That too. So if you folks, like if you need a fashion, like you're saying, if you need to find an inert gas like that, you can look in cathode ray, CRT TVs, the big box TVs. Like Terrence is saying, neon lights, because they have neon gas, it's a noble gas, or
incandescent light bulbs, but
they
are harder
to
find.
Yeah,
now.
They're definitely harder to find now. So
yeah, so there's options though. You just need to know what has inert gases.
So
in
when
them.
You have that, so let's say you find. So when you have that, what do you do next?
So then, once you have that, the mechanism behind it is essentially you have this open circuit. Mm-hmm. So what it is that there's imagine you just have like two metal wires, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. But they have some separation of distance.
Yeah.
When radiation particles come into a tube that has inert gas in them, the radiation interacts with that inert gas and actually excites that atom. So let's say it was like neon or something. that neon will actually lose an electron, or yeah, it will lose an electron, and then it will actually connect that circuit. So it will connect those two wires together, and just for that instant of time,
Second.
So then once they're connected, you actually register a voltage, or you get a current through there, and you can actually say, okay, that was actually a count of radiation.
Yeah.
So if you can just have some kind of counter on there, let's say if you had like, let's just pretend it was like an LED bulb or something, that LED could light up for that second, and then that would show you that a radiation particle flew through there. Yeah. So of course, if you have a shitload of radiation coming through that chamber, then that thing's gonna be glowing, right?
Yeah.
So if you,
I mean, even the probably the neon tube would be glowing too.
Right. And engineers, don't be turning in your, well, not guess not turning in graves, but
don't be rolling in your graves.
Yeah, don't be dying and facepalming if we're making it oversimplified. This is a physicist's interpretation.
This is a toy model, folks.
Yeah,
you don't need to go ham on it.
Yeah, don't be like, oh, you need a transistor, you need
you need a capacitor because
So yeah, we're just trying to simplify it so that, let's say, if you didn't have any other options and you had this knowledge, you may be able to figure out how to actually build it.
Yeah.
Just through trial and error and seeing what you need. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is the basic mechanism behind it.
Building a counter.
There could be some more details to it, mm-hmm. but you know, if you have some kind of physics knowledge or tech knowledge, you may be able to figure out how to actually make it so it's usable.
Yes. And that would be very useful if you could get your hands on that.
So I think a Geiger counter is probably a very important element in terms of survivability. So the reason we're spending so much time on it is because it actually is very critical if you want to have longevity to survival.
Yes.
So you're not getting anywhere if you're not able to dodge radiation. You have to be a pro at dodging radiation.
Yes.
So the more utilities and tools you have to detect it, the better.
Yeah. So any, I guess since we're talking about phase three, it's kind of like this is maybe after the initial blast and after everything is settled and for the most part. And I can tell you right now, the population is probably decimated. So you don't really need to worry about, people, you know, it's not like a zombie movie where there's a bunch of people running around and you have to worry about
a ragtag group of rednecks trying to.
You don't have to worry about any of that because most people will be dead. In fact, most people don't have the general sense of knowledge
to survive.
Probably survive an event like this. So
yeah, most people probably wouldn't even consider the radiation. They won't know enough about radiation to know the proper procedures to take.
Yeah.
So you will already be at an advantage if you have any kind of understanding.
Yeah.
Because you'll know how to navigate. You'll know that phase three of the radiation is the most critical part to survive.
Yeah. And then after that, you get out of wherever you're at, the city or something, use your counter to kind of avoid high radiation spots, get a car, get the fuck out of there. And even then, you might not find working vehicles. And in fact, you might not even have any access to any locomotion.
That's a good point, actually, that a lot of people don't realize is, a nuclear bomb is an EMP grenade too at the same time,
exactly,
because you know, you actually release a shitload of electromagnetic radiation and that can knock out a lot of electrical systems.
Yeah.
So you're also going to be dealing with an electromagnetic pulse. So your technology might be affected in a certain area.
And more than likely will be.
Yeah.
Yeah. Unless your garage is an EMP, a Faraday cage or something.
Yeah. Faraday cages are a way to mitigate electromagnetic radiation issues. So if you are prepared in that sense, and Faraday cages are easy to make, you know, you just wrap some things in metal and then, you got to be smart about it though, because you got to wrap it right.
Symmetric.
But yes. So you'll be good if you do it properly, but it's easy to do.
You can probably buy one on Amazon or like something like that. Like
you can make a Faraday cage.
You can make
Faraday cages all day.
Yeah, but if you really want to be safe, I guess, maybe put your whole car in a Faraday, like a garage. Your garage, just make it into
or you
a
just
Faraday
line
cage.
The whole inside with a Faraday cage.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's going to be very hard to find mobility and... I mean, horses aren't going to be around if you're fucking, maybe get a bike.
That's actually a good idea.
Yeah, maybe get a bike and get the fuck out of there.
But really you want to get, so I think let's kind of talk about what we would do once. I thought it'd be fun if we kind of said what we'd do. So one of my ideas was, I think I would try to head for a subway or somewhere that's really far underground is it would be the first move I think I would make to for shelter.
Yeah.
What would you do?
I mean, same thing. Like, if I heard sirens, immediately my plan of action is to go take an iodine pill, grab my bag of things that I need, like basic, like that has food for at least a week or two, water, a lot of water that I can ration reasonably, or at least a water filter type of thing, because I, once I'm out of the initial blast zone, I need to go find wilderness in enough far enough distance from the initial blast zone that I could reasonably expect not to get poisoned.
Oh, so you try to stay in the woods?
You'd have to at that point.
Because
you couldn't live in the city anymore.
Yeah,
you have no choice but to go out into the wilderness. And
okay, so you're saying if you're far away enough,
yeah,
that would probably work.
Yeah.
The only thing I would be worried about is just radiation drifting, and of course, you'll be exposed. You're going to be exposed in the atmosphere. So if there's any nuclear winter, then you'll be hit with all that radiation.
But that's what I'm saying. You need to initially get out of the blast zone, and you need to know where to go. So if the country is still sending emergency information and where you can go to seek shelter, and if it's most if it's mostly up to date, you should probably bank on that. Or unless you have a plan and you're like, I told my family and friends we're going to meet at this particular location if anything catastrophic ever happens. We're going to this national park and meeting at this location at these coordinates. You know, this is where we're going to seek shelter. Like, that would be the best plan of action if you ever want to talk about that kind of stuff with someone. Me and my friends do.
Really?
Yeah. But we're from Texas, so we just like, we have a plan.
You guys are always doomsday.
We're going to have a bunker, you know, we're all doomsday people.
Right.
So you need to, obviously you need to plan accordingly. You need to have a long-term plan about all this stuff. And if you really want to increase your chances of survival.
Right.
But
I would try to stay in the city probably, because I know I would only get food that way, because I don't know if I would be able to. Mm-hmm. Well, if
well,
I can
no,
find
I would,
a,
you would you should get food immediately. Yes, I agree.
I
with
mean,
you.
Continuously, because I don't think there would be any other way to get food continuously unless you hunted somehow in an area that was unaffected.
Yeah, but that's a good point, actually. And I was going to get to that. Like, I would, that's kind of like the in-between. I'm talking about in the span of maybe 6 months.
Yeah.
You need to find food, get water, and then live decently enough to where you can like get the tools you need to try to make it out on your own or with a group of people or basically rebuild.
Yeah.
Staying in a city with fear of radiation fallout and stuff, it's just not good.
True. You'll doom yourself to a very tough existence,
a slow death. So like Terrence is saying, that's probably the best idea. Just try to stay in the city as long until resources become
scarce.
And then get the things you need and bounce.
Yeah,
you know, obviously try to make friends.
Yep.
And because
people will survive better when numbers.
Yeah, with numbers and teamwork and stuff. And I mean,
I think it'd be kind of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I'd probably die, but
I probably would too. Because you know, it never works out how you think it's gonna work out. Like, some idiot's gonna fucking hug me and give me, you know, all the radiation.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be like, God damn it.
Just like, they're glowing and shit.
Right.
Yeah.
He'd be like, save me.
They throw up on you.
You're like, fuck.
Vomit is glowing. And he's like, oh, fuck, I'm dying.
You just know how that's, you know, it's going to play out like that. Like, there's always going to be some bullshit that happens.
Yeah, man. It's going to be terrifying. But yeah, I mean, I hope you kind of have a good idea of, you listeners, this is a very dark episode, but
yeah, but it's good knowledge, I'm sure.
I hope it gives you hope to be like, you know, there's a way we can survive this. Your chances, I want to say your chances of surviving, if you're, because I read this on, in fact, I'm going to pull that up here. We're talking about here at this particular website said, if you hit by a hydrogen bomb,
that's a fusion bomb.
Yeah. Would destroy most civilian buildings in a 10 mile radius. based on a 20 megaton weapon exploding 3.3 miles above ground. So you would be pretty much decimated after that. But you pretty much, there was a 1979 U.S. Congress Office of Technology. They published a report basically that said, what would an all-out nuclear attack look like? This was, of course, almost, 40 years ago? They said that they basically said that 80%, I think I said this in the beginning, but just to reiterate this, 80% of the population would be killed immediately, and then further casualties from radiation. So
Jesus Christ, 80% of America.
Yeah.
My
from
God.
An all-out nuclear attack.
Yeah, sounds about right. So we probably honestly wouldn't make it.
So but I'm just saying, if you're one of the 20%, that 20% doesn't even include, you're still talking about effects of radiation.
Yeah.
So don't really necessarily worry about after, having weapons and stockpiling fucking shit, because your chances of survival are very slim in this kind of scenario. So your best chances are having a plan of action.
Mm-hmm.
Making a bag where you, if I get out of this, I can at least give myself a fighting chance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, worry about the actual environmental effects rather than some dumb zombie shit where somebody's gonna steal your stuff.
Guns, fucking gotta get guns. Guns aren't gonna do shit.
Yeah,
for you.
Guns aren't gonna help you in this scenario.
Guns aren't gonna feed you, folks. Just have a plan. Stockpile water if you can. Clean water and food and basically maybe some kind of self defense in case you need it. Some ammo if you're a gun person, maybe a knife, I don't know, who knows. Just make sure your bag has iodine tablets, make sure a lot of those, make sure you have flashlights, some kind of, now they have mechanical generators or some kind of solar powered little battery thing where you can recharge.
That'd be very helpful.
Maybe you can probably do DIY of how to make your own solar panels, but that's really hard. You'd have to
That'd be kind of tough, man.
Yeah.
To reinvent a solar panel.
I was trying to do that one in my undergrad. I was trying to build my own.
Oh, and you figured out how hard that actually is.
It's really tough.
Yeah, it's not easy.
It's not easy at all. So, but it's free energy in case you run up. I mean, more than likely people will have solar panels in their house, and you might be able to if nobody's home, you might be able to take it with you and just figure something out. Basic tools are those kind of things. Try to have some form of food, water, self-defense, and then
shelter.
Yeah. Have a plan.
That is it.
And that's it, folks.
Yep. And with that, we will see you in the outro.
That was very dark. That's a very low energy episode. It kind of made me think, man, there's just no way.
What, that anybody's watching this?
No, there's just no way anyone's coming out of this alive.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
But just in case you
probably
do,
not.
You know. Probably not. But just like I said in the beginning, just try to remember us. Erect statues of us. We brought you this information,
Remember me. Was that Futurama episode?
Yeah.
But yeah, guys, just make sure once again to comment, subscribe, share, and check out the channels. Eigen Bros on Twitter. It's at Eigen Bros on Twitter, at Eigen Bros Instagram. We have eigenbros.com, the website, and then Eigen Bros 2 for the TikTok. And of course, we're on Spotify, Apple, and YouTube. So we will see you guys next episode.
Yeah.